This time on Weather Brains, we'll be talking tropics. What's that in the eastern Atlantic, and what will it do?
Where does an 800-pound gorilla go?
Well, it goes wherever it wants to.
Also this time, is the 2007 Atlantic hurricane season much ado about nothing?
Wait till the season's over.
You'll hear from one of the world's leading hurricane researchers. William Gray talks about the current season, and he's taking a new plunge into the debate about hurricanes and global warming.
If we can't get it right in 10 days, how in the world can we get it right in 100 years?
So what happens when the tropics get active and you're dealing with a weather show that's not really scripted?
Well, let's do this. This is totally impromptu and unrehearsed.
Things can happen on the spur of the moment, so get ready to take part in a little guessing game. It's some Weather Brains fun. Also this time, the journalist who criticizes his own news organization for its global warming coverage.
It's good to see finally a journalist stepping up and saying, hey, this is absolute insanity.
Plus, staying cool in the heat, J.B. Elliott looks at how air conditioning got its start. And on Weather Brains 101, Professor Peters explains all about ring lore. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray remembers the devastation of Hurricane Camille. It's all coming up. It's episode number 81 of Weather Brains, the show that's all about weather, produced by the Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. With me for this ride, a whole bunch of motley individuals like James Spann, Brian Peters, J.B. Elliott, and Bill Murray. I don't know where this show's going to go. Bill Murray, where are you? How are you?
I'm actually at home tonight, David, which I'm very glad to say because it's been a crazy several months and been having to entertain and do things on Monday nights and been missing the show a lot.
Well, we are glad that you are able to join us. J.B. Elliott, glad to have you along for the ride. What's new with you?
Nothing new. I'm semi-hot.
Yeah. Semi, if you're lucky, pal, if you're only semi. J.B. and Bill happen to live only a couple of miles, I guess, from each other in the arid, drought, parched southeastern United States, state of Alabama, where it's above 100 degrees every day, it seems like. James Spann, 100 degrees for you, too.
Hey, bring it on.
All right. Brian Peters, what you know? How are you?
Well, if JB is semi-hot, then I must be semi-arid.
Semi-arid. Does that mean like you use deodorant or something, or is that a whole different thing? I don't know what that means.
I think that's a whole different thing, you know.
Fair enough.
With all the heat and all the dry air and lack of moisture and 25 inches below normal, we're going to become the desert southeast.
Yes, if you live in parts of the United States or other parts of the planet where you get something called rain, consider yourself fortunate. It's a rarity in some parts of the globe at this time. And we are looking at a couple of spots on the globe, one of them in particular with great interest. The tropics are making the news, and we're going to talk tropically a lot in this episode of Weather Brains. First, it's a little early to make any specific calls, I suppose, about a tropical depression heading west across the eastern Atlantic. In fact, by the time a lot of folks are listening to this netcast, it will no doubt be a tropical storm. But it's still fun to speculate. We'll talk about that. And then we'll look at the latest revision to the activity forecast for the 2007 Atlantic hurricane season. First off, what's happening in the Atlantic? James, what are your thoughts on what's brewing out in the eastern Atlantic?
I think we ought to go around the show here and everybody pick their landfall.
Oh, that sounds like fun. We have a prize contest.
I think we ought to do that. We can give away a Weather Brains cookbook or something.
I've got something we can give away. I've got a great Hurricane Camille book that someone sent me that gave me a duplicate. It's Roar of the Storm or whatever it was. It's about Hurricane Camille, which is her anniversary this week.
Well, let's do this. Let's just do this. It's totally impromptu and unrehearsed. If anybody listening to us wants to guess now, let's say you've got to submit your entry by Thursday, August the 16th. Is that a Thursday?
That's right.
Thursday the 16th. Okay.
All right. Just follow along here.
How specific do they have to be?
You have to do it by email and just use our question email address, question@weatherbrain.com, and we'll say the deadline is midnight Thursday night, August the 16th, and we want to know the landfall prediction you have of TD number 4, which is now Tropical Depression 4, maybe deemed by the time you hear this show. And the one closest to the landfall will get that book that Bill just talked about. And everybody on the show gets to guess, too.
And we probably need a tiebreaker, James, so like the intensity of the storm maybe in you know, miles per hour, perhaps, at landfall?
Sure.
Because we might get more than one correct answer.
Sustained winds at the time of landfall.
Okay, we'll go over these rules again before the end of the show, but let me make one quick clarification. The email address is question@weatherbrains.com. So,
yeah, what did I say? I probably said something wrong.
I thought you said weather brains singer, but maybe I missed it.
Oh,
I don't know.
No, obviously we have no brains here. But what makes this interesting, at the time we're doing this show, we have seen GFS runs that one run took it into Mexico near Tampico. One run took it up into the central Gulf Coast near Mobile Bay. And the most recent run I've seen took it to New York City. So
you've covered the gamut. There's no question.
Tampico to Maine. Kenny Bunkport is in play here. So that's what I like about this contest.
Anywhere in
the entire United States should be on alert.
And out of everybody on this show, J.B. Elliott knows where it's going. And I think we need to start with him.
Fess up.
Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale, according to J.B. Elliott. Is that going to be
north? By the way, we're not eligible for the prize.
Right.
The prize goes to the first, obviously, listener.
JB, north or south of the interstate?
Right down the center stripe.
Okay. Landfall near the barbecue restaurant or near the gas station?
It'll be right over our hotel in the middle of Fort Lauderdale is where it'll be. Probably.
Near Applebee's.
Okay, you heard it there. But anybody else can make that same entry, and they could win because JB's not eligible. So question at weatherbrains.com for, and it would be Tropical Storm Dean, you said. Is that right, James?
Yeah, unless this thing, and there's a little front runner that might get a name, but the big one's going to be this one, or should be this one coming out of the eastern Atlantic, a Cape Verde hurricane. So, of course, you know, watch the thing just fizzle and dissipate.
Exactly.
Okay.
You can't guess no landfall. That's a very good guess, but we have to pick a point, assuming it makes it.
Well, let me ask you guys something from a forecast perspective, and, you know, you're talking about what the models are showing, that it could be anywhere. Is that part of the inherent difficulty of trying to forecast what one of these systems is going to do? The models are not really that much help at this point, are they?
Well, absolutely. It's typically, you know, the position of the steering currents. You know, you've got the Bermuda Ridge. You've got weaknesses in there. You've got potential weaknesses. You've got a potential trough. How does this thing interact? Where does it recurve? Does it recurve? Does it keep going across the Yucatan into Mexico? And there are more, questions than answers at the time we're doing this show. So, but I've heard one pick of Fort Lauderdale here, and I'm writing these down.
Okay.
My guess, James, is that it's going to brush the Outer Banks of North Carolina as it recurves.
You're going to hit New York City or just to touch?
No, I think it'll just hit the Outer Banks as it's curving out to sea.
Okay. Brian Peters is good at this.
Yeah, Brian.
No, I'm not, because you removed the one I wanted.
Oh.
Lack of landfall.
It fizzles out, yeah. Or no landfall at all.
No landfall.
That could happen if the trough is strong enough to recurve it, for sure.
Well, that's just it. There could be a good weakness in the upper ridge, especially at 700 millibars, and if it goes into that. Because I like to think of it as, where does an 800-pound gorilla go? Well, it goes wherever it wants to, and when the tropics are rather flat, as they are right now, but I'll go ahead and just, you know, throw my name in the ring. I'll go for Key West.
Okay.
I'm going to go for this one in honor of Kevin Selly. Galveston.
Oh.
Galveston.
Okay.
He's been calling Galveston for like 8 years now, so at some point, you know, he's got to be right, so... I'll go in Galveston.
Okay, Galveston for Kevin, and I'll go a little bit down the road for Corpus Christi.
That's a pretty good guess, David.
Of course, who knows who's going to be here, but it's going to be fun to see what happens. Anyway, if you want to enter the contest, the address again is question@weatherbrains.com for your email submission. All right, Colorado State University's Tropical Meteorology Project team has slightly lowered the number of hurricanes predicted for this season, but team members say they still expect this season to be very active. The team now estimates we'll see about 8 hurricanes and 15 named storms, with 4 hurricanes predicted to become intense. Now, the team earlier this year had predicted 9 hurricanes, 17 named storms, and 5 intense hurricanes. Professor Emeritus Dr. William Gray is the man many in tropical meteorology consider to be the father of hurricane research. We caught up with Dr. Gray to ask about his team's forecast revision. He says conditions in the Atlantic seem a little less favorable for tropical development.
Well, probably due to the ocean, northeastern Atlantic Ocean temperatures, they've come down a little bit. But I don't think we still have quite an active forecast out there.
Still a good likelihood of U.S. landfall, perhaps?
Well, we think it's above average. We can't. Nobody can say. But I would say the odds are above average, above the average year for landfall, sure, because we're going to have an active season. Typically, if the Atlantic Basin is more active, the probability or the frequency of U.S. landfall is greater.
So for people who think that this is not going to be a very active season based on what's happened so far, your message is...
Oh, yeah, we haven't gotten very far. I mean, I have a bell out here. I ring it on August 20th. That's the start of the active part of the season. Fact is, we haven't had much so far. Doesn't mean anything. Wait till the season's over.
All right, Dr. William Gray. While the Colorado State team has lowered its predictions, so too have forecasters with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They're calling for up to 9 hurricanes and up to 16 tropical storms this season, with 3 to 5 of those storms becoming strong. NOAA's earlier estimate called for 17 tropical storms and 10 hurricanes. This season has been relatively tame so far, but tropical experts are telling us, watch out, starting in August, that can mark the start of some of the most active months of Atlantic weather. Meanwhile, controversy surrounding the findings of two researchers who say the number of tropical storms developing annually in the Atlantic more than doubled over the past century. They say the increases coincide with rising sea surface temperatures, largely the byproduct of human-induced climate warming. The research team is made up of Greg Holland, who's director of mesoscale and microscale meteorology at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and fellow researcher Peter J. Webster. The team's findings were set to be published by Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London. Now, Chris Lancey, who is the science and operations officer at the National Hurricane Center, calls the research sloppy science. Dr. William Gray, meanwhile, has taken his views about hurricanes and global warming to the public in the form of a commentary called Hurricanes and Hot Air. It was published in the July 26th Wall Street Journal. We asked Dr. Gray about his reasons for writing that commentary. Do you hope that your views on hurricanes and global warming may alter some of the impressions people are being given by some of the others in the research community?
Yeah. They're just terrible. Well, since the very active 04 and 05 seasons, there have been these papers. Some of my colleagues, very prestigious, talented people, have been coming out and saying that human-induced global greenhouse gases are likely a component in this. And things are getting worse. Well, in the Atlantic Basin, they have gotten worse since 1995. But these are natural changes due to the Atlantic Ocean circulations variations. I don't think there's any significant influence from the CO2 picking up. That's my view on it, and I think these other people that have been stressing it have a vested interest in it. You know, the government, the federal government, gives out so much money to people who support the global human-induced global warming hypothesis that I think there's a lot of influence there, you know.
You feel that some of
the number one thing a scientist wants is or needs is what? His salary.
Money.
Grants, yes. Federal grants. So when the federal government is giving out grants and they're hyping this global warming thing, you better be on that side. If you're on the other side like I am, you don't stand good chances of getting funds.
You consider yourself a black sheep?
No, I consider I'm 77. I've earned my retirement. If they can't take that away, I'm going to tell the truth as best I can. I have no vested interest in whether greenhouse gases are an important feature or not. But I've been studying hurricanes over 50 years, and everything I know about them and about these multi-decadal cycles say that this is natural stuff, and it's the pickup of the CO2 in the whole energy budget point of view is very small. The contributions there are very small, and they couldn't be causing the sort of changes we've seen since 1995.
And you really feel some of the currents in the Atlantic are probably much more at play in this.
Oh, yeah. They are the dominant thing, in my view, yes.
I mean,
and a lot of that is related to salinity changes, multi-decadal salinity changes that come and go, and it has nothing to do with the greenhouse gas pickups. And I think in time, when this active cycle will run its course, we will then maybe slip back into a period like we had from 1970 to 94, when we didn't have so many major Atlantic Basin hurricanes.
Your commentary talks about climate modelers not having much observational experience. If they did, do you think that might alter their views?
Yes. Yes, most of them are very good programmers and things. Very few of them have ever made a forecast in their life. Very few of them can go up to a weather map and talk intelligently about it.
That's Dr. William Gray, Professor Emeritus at Colorado State University. If you'd like to check out Dr. Gray's commentary in the Wall Street Journal, or if you'd like to look at that report about findings by Greg Holland and Peter Webster, we've got links to both of those items on our website, weatherbrains.com. Any thoughts about hurricanes, gang?
All I can say is amen. And, you know, it's interesting, David, a minute ago we were talking about the incredible inconsistencies in the primary global model on a tropical system 7 to 10 days out. And as Dr. Gray points out, these climate researchers are using global models to predict the state of the Earth's climate in 50 to 100 years. If we can't get it right in 10 days, how in the world can we get it right in 100 years?
Absolutely.
Double amen.
Yeah, very good point. Let's move on to the Weather Roundtable. Mr. Murray, what would you like to bring to the Weather Roundtable?
Well, you know, James points out how little progress we're making in some areas, but, you know, going back and looking at Hurricane Camille, which was probably the first hurricane that I ever remember, it's amazing to me how far we've come, really, and just you know, the amount of time since that hurricane occurred, less than 40 years ago. Because when you go back and you read about Dr. Robert Simpson, the director of the National Hurricane Center, literally not knowing whether this storm that was sitting in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico was intensifying or weakening, you know, and which direction it was even moving until, you know, until they got a plane into it. We really are blessed today with all of the satellite information that we have and the great radars. And even though we fuss at these models, at least, you know, they, as we go through time, they do help us a lot as we try to decide, you know, where the track was going. And something that they just were developing back then, we know it today as, I think, Slosh and other models like that. They were developing something called Splash. And when they got the output that Sunday morning, it showed that the storm surge was going to be 22.6 feet. And they went, that's impossible. And, you know, they didn't even really start to buy into it till later that day when the Air Force recon plane radioed back and said, guys, this is like nothing we've ever seen before. Our scale stops at 150 miles an hour, and this is way worse than anything that's on the scale, because they estimated the winds by looking down at the sea surface in the eye and seeing how chaotic it was, and they estimated that the winds were 190 miles an hour. And that turned out to be a very accurate estimation when the hurricane finally moved on shore later that night.
But, you know, if you think back to that time when the technology was so much more primitive, for them to have seen even suggestions of readings like that, I would imagine, gave them great cause to question, you know, the reliability of their equipment. This can't be right.
And well, as we hear in this week in weather history later, you'll see that if the plane, you know, the planes were diverted that weekend because they were in another project for something called Project Storm Fury. And if those planes had not been available, we might never have really known that Saturday how strong the hurricane was. And the warnings wouldn't have been as good, and the catastrophe would have been even worse on the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
And we've gone from that stage back then to today, where you can fire up your wireless laptop computer, log on, and see the data buoy reports almost real time from out in the Gulf, as well as you mentioned, radar and satellite imagery. It is amazing.
Speaking when Brian and I were on the Gulf Coast during Katrina, David, we were looking at the actual slosh models that Sunday night that were showing, you know, the inundation, you know, of New Orleans and the Mississippi coast, and it was amazing to see it, you know, playing out before our very eyes, you know, hours before the hurricane arrived.
And how long will it be before we have another one like that? James Spann, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to salute a journalist, and I rarely do that these days.
All right.
A guy named Robert J. Samuelson is a contributing editor of Newsweek, and he basically slapped down his own magazine for a cover story that they ran on the, quote, global warming denial machine. He called it a highly contrived story, and he explains that the magazine used discredited allegations. And I don't know if you guys saw this. It was an issue that involved a supposed cash bounty to pay skeptics to dispute global warming science. And he went on and just really slapped the magazine down for portraying global warming as a morality tale. And just it's good to see finally a journalist stepping up and saying, hey, this is absolute insanity. Another thing he wrote, he said, unfortunately, self-righteous indignation can undermine good journalism. And last week's Newsweek cover story on global warming was a sobering reminder. So he basically debunked their own embarrassing cover story a week later. So hats off to journalist Robert J. Samuelson for allowing the idea that there are two sides to every story and that both sides need to be told.
His rebuttal will be in this week's edition, right?
Yep, sure will.
My copy will come in the mail tomorrow. I'll save it.
That was the most one-sided, horrible, horrible piece of journalism I've ever seen. There are two sides to this story, and I think that topped it all. Nothing will be as bad as that. So congratulations to Samuelson and the guts to step up and say, hey, this is horrible.
You don't see that happen very often. J.B. Elliott, what's on your mind for the Weather Roundtable?
I wanted to talk about the days before air conditioning.
Ooh, I don't think I like this already, but go ahead.
There were some?
Yeah, we had some. We had one of those last Thursday night when air conditioning went out, JB.
Oh, boy, that's tough. There's plenty of heat to go around, we all know now, in various parts of the country. Even Dallas-Fort Worth had their first 100-degree heat over the weekend. They've had the rain and the floods, and they usually have a lot of days with 100 by now, but not this year. But there's plenty of heat to go around, and we're going through one of the worst heat waves in the southeast part of the nation. But can you imagine going through all of that without any air conditioning? In the early days, there was no air conditioning, and there was much suffering from the heat. But soon after the turn of the century, a printing concern in New York City talked to a young engineer fresh out of Cornell to find a way to keep the printing presses a constant temperature so the paper would not shift. His name was Willis Carrier. That was the beginning, but it was not until later that the public could enjoy the comfort of air conditioning. It was first used for the public in a theater in New York City in 1911, and right after that, well, a few years after that, it was followed by air conditioning, the New Empire Theater in Montgomery, Alabama, and one in Chicago, both of those in 1917. But it was not until after World War II that air conditioning really blossomed in people's homes. And until then, other methods were tried, such as letting a fan blow across a washtub full of ice-cold water or hanging a wet sheet and blowing a fan through that to get the evaporative cooling. And here in the southern USA, there's a vine called kudzu. It grows very rapidly and covers much ground, telephone poles, signs, anywhere you plant it, it grows instantly. Some folks even say you can see it grow, but growing up in the South, I used to hear stories that some people in rural areas would plant a sprig or two on the west and south side of their homes to shield the house from the direct sun in the hottest part of the day. I think some of that occurred during the 1925 heat wave all across the South. much suffering from the heat during the Dust Bowl years in the 1930s, when many places in the Plain State had their hottest weather ever. In Lincoln, Nebraska, during the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s and during the heat waves, residents actually gathered on the grounds of the state capitol and spent the night in the open because the buildings were too hot to sleep. So let's be thankful for air conditioning, Mr. Carrier's early expertise.
Man, I tell you what, it just amazes me to think about how long so many families everywhere just operated without air conditioning, never thought about it. You know, you don't know what you don't know. You don't have what you don't have. So
right.
We are grateful for what we have today and all the technology and should not take it for granted. And I'm not going to take Mr. Peters for granted because he's a good guy and you probably have something to contribute to the roundtable too, don't you?
Oh, yes. I always have something to contribute. I have an opinion. Just ask me.
Uh-oh.
I couldn't help but think, as Bill and James were talking about, you know, James talking about the fellow who's trying to call a spade and Bill talking about how far we've come. I couldn't help but once again think about Bill Proenza and his troubles relative to bringing attention to QuickScat and how important it is. And, you know, it's one of those things that it's a tool, yes, and there's been a kind of a hullabaloo about whether that tool is all that important, but when Bill was talking about how far we've come, I was thinking that, you know, we don't want to lose any of the tools that we have. I mean, we keep making everything we have better, and yet losing any of the tools seems to me to be a big mistake. So I haven't heard any news this week about Bill's situation, but I certainly hope he comes out on top.
We'll follow that and see what happens on that.
I hope so, too.
Let's check the Weather Brains email bag. We heard this week from Russell Thomas in Birmingham, Alabama, a member of the amateur radio group Alert, and Russell has a question. He says, quote, I was on a short vacation in Dauphin Island, Alabama, and saw something interesting and thought I would ask the geniuses. Hey, Russell, if you think that's Weather Brains, forget it. Anyway, after Katrina, the town decided to set up a berm, which is basically a 6 to 8 foot mound of sand just about right on the beach, with the idea that it would preserve the beach and help protect the houses if there was ever another hurricane. So residents must construct a bridge to walk over the berm to get to the beach. A few will be provided by the city. I wanted to get your thoughts on this approach. Do you think it will work? Anybody have any thoughts on that for Russell?
I don't see how it could work very long unless concrete's mixed in with it to really solidify it.
Get a woolly booger of a hurricane, huh? It's going to take it right out.
Yeah, I think any major hurricane, David, he's going to be amazed at how fast that berm's going to disappear. Maybe something minor, it might it might protect them from a weak storm. But anything like we saw with Katrina or Dennis or any of these storms, it's going to be all over with.
Yeah, you know, we call those islands out there, I think they have a name.
Barrier Island. That's it. Very good.
And they have a name like that for a reason. They're a barrier, and we keep wanting to build permanent structures on them. I think that's the big mistake.
What's wrong with that picture? All right.
Right.
Got a voicemail from one Weather Brains caller. Let's check that out.
Hi, James. This is Mike Wilhelm. I was calling to ask, how much do you all believe that the drought conditions that we've experienced over the last few years have affected our recent heat wave? Thanks.
Mr. Spann?
One of our associates is a guy named Tim Coleman, and I think everybody here knows Tim. He is a brilliant research meteorologist who is with the University of Alabama in Huntsville. In fact, he has been a recent blog contributor.
And he was on our show talking about gravity waves.
Yeah, and he's just a great guy. And he posted a note on the blog called Heat Wave Physics, and he posted graphics of latent heat flux and sensible heat flux. And what that has to do is the soil moisture. And basically, those graphics indeed proved that that's the main reason we are as hot as we are in the southeast United States, where there's plenty of moisture in the ground. The same conditions would net temperatures almost 8, 9, 10 degrees lower than what we have right now. So as J.B. Elliott says so many times, heat waves and droughts go hand in hand, and this is a classic example, because the sun doesn't have to work on evaporating soil moisture. All of the energy goes to heating the ground, which in turn heats the air, and you know the rest is history.
Fair enough. Let's move on to the Weather Center. Ring around the sun, ring around the moon. So what do those terms mean, and how much truth do they carry? This time on WeatherBrains 101, we learn about ring lore, courtesy of the infamous and distinguished Professor Peters. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks back at Camille, the 1969 hurricane that brought catastrophic damage to the Gulf Coast. It's all part of the Weather Center.
WeatherBrains 101 with Professor Peters.
Weather has its share of folklore and odd sayings. One of the most commonly heard items is, a ring around the sun or moon means rain or snow coming soon. There is some truth to this lore that works most often in the cool season and in the mid-latitudes. Mid-latitude storm systems and fronts are more common in the cool season. It also applies to tropical storms and hurricanes, since thin high clouds occur around the periphery of those storm systems. As an upper-level disturbance or a warm front approaches, the clouds tend to start off as high clouds. Over time, the clouds gradually lower and thicken. Near the source of the greatest synoptic lift is where precipitation and thick clouds are most likely to happen. The sun or moon will no longer be visible once the clouds thicken too much. The ring around the sun or the moon is a result of ice crystals within thin cirrus clouds. The refraction causes light to shine in a ring. Cirrus clouds are generally the first layer of clouds that are seen as a storm system approaches. Applying this little ditty requires some caution, though. Cirrus clouds not associated with the storm system will also produce the ring. In these cases, precipitation may not occur at all. Well, that rings out another WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of August 14th through the 20th. Now, from the beginning, it was evident that the third named storm of the 1969 North Atlantic hurricane season would be an explosive one. Satellite technology back then was primitive. The eyes and ears of the National Hurricane Center were reconnaissance aircraft. By the time the first recon plane reached the disturbance south of Cuba, back on Thursday, August 14th, 1969, it was already a tropical storm. By afternoon, the central pressure had plummeted to 964 millibars, and Camille was a hurricane. On the Mississippi coast, residents kept a wary eye on the young storm as it intensified. Top winds of 115 miles an hour was moving toward western Cuba and toward the southeastern Gulf of Mexico on that Friday, August the 15th. Now in the Atlantic, another storm formed that same day. It was named Debbie. Far out over the ocean, but within the range of Navy planes, Debbie was the perfect candidate for a project called Storm Fury. Storm Fury sought to modify hurricanes by dropping silver iodide into the feeder bands in an effort to disorganize it and weaken the storm. There had been some successes. Debbie was a good candidate. But unfortunately, this took all the planes to Puerto Rico. On the morning of Saturday the 16th, Camille was over the Gulf, 420 miles south of Panama City. The familiar orange and black square flag signifying a hurricane watch went up from Biloxi, Mississippi to St. Marks, Florida at 8 a.m. Central Daylight Time. That watch was upgraded to a hurricane warning some 3 hours later. Now, NHC Director Robert Simpson was very worried. Satellite imagery showed a big blob in the Gulf, but the pictures were not detailed enough to tell him what he needed to know. In fact, the satellite experts told him that the storm was actually weakening, but he knew in his gut that couldn't be true. He needed real data, but for now, all his planes were off on a mission. He bugged the Air Force to take a plane out of Illinois and fly into the storm. And that plane did that Saturday afternoon, and it confirmed his worst fears, radioing back a central pressure of an amazing 26.72 inches, second only to the all-time storm of that day, the 1935 Labor Day hurricane. The pressure in that storm was 26.35 inches. Camille was a monster, had top winds of 160 miles an hour. Now, this information allowed Simpson and forecasters to communicate the magnitude of the threat to the Gulf Coast residents that were at risk. Now, all Saturday night, the advisories targeted a landfall on the Florida Panhandle, but as the storm came under the surveillance of coastal radars, it was evident that it was moving more northwest toward the Alabama and Mississippi coast rather than northeast toward the Florida coast. Warnings were shifted frantically westward at 5 a.m. on Sunday. Now, Wade Geist, the civil defense director in Harrison County, Mississippi, would say there was no better time for an evacuation than a Sunday morning. And that turned out to be true, as nearly half of the residents evacuated from the storm area. A storm surge of 15 feet helped prompt them from their homes on that day. Now, at early afternoon, another Air Force reconnaissance plane penetrated the center of Kamil, found an even lower pressure, 26.62 inches. Now, they sort of estimated the surface winds in reconnaissance flights back then, based on the condition of the sea surface visible from the plane, but the cruise scale stopped at 150 miles an hour. They said that it was way worse than anything that their scale showed, and that anything that their training had allowed for. They estimated the winds at 190 miles an hour. Now back at the Hurricane Center, a new computer program called Splash was being developed. When it was run that morning, it showed that tides would be over 20 feet on the Mississippi coast. Now even Robert Simpson could not believe that, but he went ahead and raised the forecast surge to 20 feet on the Mississippi coast. And that got a lot of people's attention. Now, when Kamil came ashore around 11 p.m. that evening, Sunday, August the 17th, it produced a storm surge of 22.6 feet at Pass Christiane, so those forecasts were actually low. The devastation was incredible. A total of 172 people died on the Mississippi coast. Another 100 would die in flooding in Virginia and West Virginia from the remnants of Kamil. Robert Simpson would say that by any yardstick, Kamil was the greatest storm of any kind to have affected the United States. 36 years later, the Mississippi coast and New Orleans area would be visited by another terrible storm, that one named Katrina. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray, producer of This Week in Weather History. That is Weather Center for this episode of Weather Brains.
What kind of bumper music was that?
Sinister Kamil music.
That was the Brian Peters Orchestra.
I hate all bumper music.
Where did that come from?
By the way, on the night of August 17th, I was on vacation from the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City. I drove up onto a bench area on the Wasatch Mountains and tuned in my AM radio to 870 WWL in New Orleans and listened to it for hours, and it was a play-by-play.
Yeah, but that was interesting to listen to. You couldn't exactly flip on a TV, right?
No TV.
Hey, JB, you remember the sponsor for the time checks on WWL at night?
Not right off, I don't.
King Edward's Cigar.
Oh, yes, yes.
King Edward's Cigar time on WWL.
Yes.
You're dating yourselves.
That was a rat hole.
Yeah.
Fair enough. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. That's also the address you can use for the Tropical Storm / Hurricane Dean contest. The rules again, James, Bill?
That's you get them in by Thursday night at midnight and give us the landfall point and the maximum sustained winds at landfall, and we will first pick a winner from the landfall. We'll tie break with the winds, and the winner will get a great book about Hurricane Kamil.
And Thursday night being August 16th, as far as the deadline. If you'd like to leave a voicemail for us and talk about weather with us, our toll-free telephone number is 1-888-247-8627. That's 888-247-8627. Some of the music provided in this episode of Weather Brains came from the Pod Show, PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. For the Weather Brains crew, Bill Murray, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, and James Spann, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. Hope you can join us again next time. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios. Enjoyed the program, guys. We had a lot of information in there. A pretty meaty show.
Very packed.
Nice.
And lots of fun.
But some bad bumper music.
Yeah, JB will trash the bumper music. JB has voted thumbs down on that.
I heard a traffic report on a local station yesterday to where the bumper music sounded like metal scrubbing against each other, and I could hardly hear what the traffic was.
Maybe it was for an accident report, JB.
I guess.
You know, I remember back as a kid watching the local news in my hometown on the 10 o'clock news when they showed video of wrecks, the old film days. They ran this really sinister, dramatic music under the wrecks and the stabbings and all that stuff. You guys remember any of that?
Yeah, I used to do severe weather coverage for one of the local stations here in town. I don't anymore, so I won't mention the name, but there was one guy on one of the FM stations that insisted on playing bumper music when I was given a severe thunderstorm warning.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, all right, JB, no more bumper music for you.
Good.
We'll let the producers know.
Great.
All right, you guys. See y'all.
See you, boys.
Bye.
Enjoy.
Bye.